Hit it.
Hey, everyone. We've got another Left of Boom show. Today, Michael and I are joined by Dana Wood and Tim Fadum of Envision Strategic Solutions. It's a fractional HR consulting firm. We talk a little bit about what fractional HR is all about, some great leadership tips. Dana's got a new book coming out, From the Mailroom to the Boardroom. And then we also talk about our dream concerts. So hope you enjoy this week's episode.
All right. Hey, everyone. This is Michael Vandervoort. We're back with another episode of the Left the Boom show. Good morning, Phil. We're going to introduce our guests in just a second. Today, we're going to talk on, we're going to touch on a few topics, kind of one of our classic evergreen topics, which is leadership and some specific ideas around that that our guests will share. We're also going to talk a bit about the food service industry and kind of the state of affairs there, and also a bit about what seems to be an emerging and trendy topic, which is the use of fractional HR services to help support business and industry. And then we'll close with hopefully a fun little exercise. So I want to welcome our guests. Our guests today are Dana Wood and Tim Fadum from Envision Strategic Solutions. Good morning and welcome to Left the Boom Show. How are you guys doing today?
We're doing great.
Yeah, good morning. Doing great. Welcome.
Good morning. Doing well. Thank you.
I should also mention that my co-host, Phil Wilson, is with us, as you can see. I always forget to introduce Phil or I say good morning, Phil. Anyway, so let's start with Dana. And just for the benefit of our listeners, quick introduction of who you are and what you do.
Okay. Yeah. So good morning, everybody. So yes, so I've got 30 years of experience in leadership in human resources is kind of the main focus of my career. Those years were mostly spent with a large food service distributor and in the food service industry with Gordon Food Service, and kind of started from the ground floor up, started as a frontline supervisor. Spent many years doing that in a mailroom, which we had mailrooms back in those days. I'm dating myself here, but and then I worked my way up into human resources, which we'll talk more about later. It's kind of a general attrition into the HR field, and I'm just passionate about leadership. I think in today's environment, and I've dealt with in my career, unfortunately, leaders that need a lot of help in understanding the human aspect of leading, right? I think we as leaders get the financial aspects and having to do that, but I'm just passionate about teaching from the HR perspective and the people focus of HR. So, and then today, now I work in HR consulting with that theme, staying with that theme of helping leaders learn to, consider people and love their people, so to speak. So.
Cool. And we'll touch on it in a little bit later, but you're also a published author of a book or two, right?
Yeah.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of starting from the mailroom.
Yes.
I was a letter carrier for the U.S. Postal Service in the late 70s and early 80s for 6 years. And I was back in the day before you had anything like FedEx or whatever. So I was reading some of the intro to your book this morning, Dana. And, you're talking about stamps and sorting papers and stapling things. You know, it's a whole different world today, right? But anyway.
Yeah, it was. We didn't have, to your point, Michael, we didn't have email or intranets or anything like that. We had voicemail, though. But that was about it. And it was unique. Gordon Food Service was unique in that we sent all of our intercompany mail on our own trucks. We didn't U.S. mail a lot of stuff. It was all had to package up. You know, we probably had 120 boxes, so to speak, each day that went out to, like, if you were a salesman in Kalamazoo, Michigan, you would get your invoices, you would get your benefit checks, you would get everything via paychecks. That was before, direct deposit. You'd get everything via our trucks. So it was a pretty big operation.
I'm imagining the mail room from Elf, where they have like all the tubes going in. And
anyway. Absolutely. Yes.
So Tim, I don't know what your, origin story is as your first job, but why don't you go ahead and share the same info? Tell us who you are, and what you do.
Well, I, I like to thank you and welcome, and thanks for having us today. But I like to start out that I guess first and foremost, I'm a husband to Jill and a father of three kids, and just became a grandfather.
Nice, congratulations,
congrats.
That's been extremely exciting. But yeah, my career has mostly been with the same organization with Dana. We worked together for, I think we were counting today, like 25, probably 30 years. And I started in sales when I was 21 years old. A lot of those mail packages I got came probably from you, Dana. They came down to us. But I spent a number of years in sales, about 8 years in sales in 99. The head of HR wanted to see me in his office. And I thought, oh, boy, what did I do? Am I going to be fired here today? And they brought me in and said, hey, I'd like you to, you know, be a leader in the human resources area. And it took a totally different turn than I anticipated early in my career. And I spent the next 20 plus years in human resources. And then in 99, or I'm sorry, in 2019, I left and kind of semi-retired from GFS and started Envision Strategic Solutions. And that's where Dan and I are working together today. And we have a couple of other partners we work with. But over the years, we've had the chance and pleasure to work with Phil, and Phil's been a trusted advisor and help for us. That's how we connected years ago, Phil, and we appreciated the support and what you guys are about. I think we aligned a lot on how we view people and how a company should be run, and you know what produces a better company. And a lot of it, that's around relationships, and I think that's where Dana and I are. Our focus as Envision is, you know, how do we improve employer-employee relationships so that the company can function as effective as possible. And so that's what we're doing today. And yeah, it's been fun. We've been really enjoying it. And it's something that we look forward to doing for a lot of years to come.
Yeah, it's been cool to, you know, work with you, you know, on the company side. And then, you know, now you're on this new adventure together, and it's not even that new now, but yeah, it's great kind of just continuing the work that you were doing in-house now for others.
Exactly. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So that was one of the first things I wanted to ask you about, because like it probably happens all the time. And like, I mean, Phil hired me a couple years ago, and we've known each other for years. So it's certainly not unusual that you know, partner up with people that you've worked with, but your company, sir, you have like four people that all kind of work together. And that, you know, that speaks to like either a very good relationship over a long time or some complimentaries. So how did you decide to take that step, and how did you guys find yourselves working together? Just kind of curious about that.
Yeah, that's a good question. And you know, after working so many years together, you develop some pretty good working relationships and friendships. And Dana was one of those. And the other two that are part of Envision, Dave and Barry, you know, we've got, you know, wonderful relationships and have worked through a lot of different situations. Mm-hmm. And implemented a lot of different things. We've done acquisitions and downsizings and you know, tried to respond to union threats and so on. And so, but we just really enjoyed working together. And as we stepped away from you know, our day job, so to speak, we wanted to stay active. We wanted to, you know, we like to keep our minds fresh. We like to engage with companies. And is there a way we can give back? You know, when you start out with your first job, when I was first starting, I was just happy to make $20,000 a year and have a company car and be able to sell, you know, and hopefully that I got what it takes, you know, and am I going to be able to pay the bills? And we're in a different stage now where, you know, what can we do to kind of share some of the things we've learned with organizations that are going through growing pains or dealing with issues that maybe we can be of help. And so we partner together on different things, depending on the client. You know, we'll kind of decide who's going to kind of work on what. But it's been a good relationship. I think one of the challenges is that we've done so much over the years. I mean, we've worked on so many different projects. It's like, you know, could you do this? And the answer is, yeah, we probably could. Do we want to? That might be another question. The other day, a a couple months ago, somebody asked about, hey, would you do a compensation project for it? And could I do it? I probably could. Do I want to? No, I don't think so. But we know somebody. So I would kind of say no to the things that just aren't in our wheelhouse or, you know, where we want to be. I think we got to be careful around that, you know, but there's a number of areas where we can come alongside an organization and help them improve.
I would say one of the big keys to being successful in consulting is fighting that urge to say yes to everything that comes across your desk, and focusing on like, what are you great at? What can you be the best at and do more of that? And don't say yes to everything that you could, you know, do.
Yeah. Like in our case, I haven't been around for a lot of this ride, but like we've developed specific kind of like partnerships with people that are experts. To your point, like you said, you know somebody that could do a comp project, so it becomes a referral where maybe then you get something back someday, right? But Phil's point, it lets you practice what you want to practice. How about you, Dana? What's your perspective on this?
Yeah, I think an interesting note, I agree with what Tim said, but an interesting note is that the other, with Tim and the other two partners in Envision, they've all at one point been my boss at some point. So, but it's been great. It's, as Tim mentioned, it's been the relationships. And because we know each other so well, and I think the thing that really works too is we know each other's strengths and weaknesses. Like Tim said, a comp project. No, that's not in our wheelhouse. Tim's the analytical one, I think. Tim, and Tim's the good business planner. I'm more the big picture. I like employee engagement, employee relations. I like leadership development. That's my thing. Our other business partner, he's into, you know, the benefits area. So we all kind of bring something different to that. And we all know each other's, like I mentioned, strengths and weaknesses. So that's been great.
Cool. So one of the things, like you guys came out of the food service side, the warehousing and delivery side, and I know that when we did a call a while back, you're providing some fractional services in the restaurant industry, and I don't know where this will take us exactly, but that's a volatile industry right now. There's the 800 pound gorilla in the room is Starbucks, which Phil and I have talked with other guests about on, you know, the union organizing they're experiencing and some of the business difficulties that they've had with the corporate campaign. Red Lobster and Mod Pizza and a number of other chains are going out. I mean, it's always volatile, but it seems maybe like this is more challenging now than ever. And I think there are a few, like the pandemic drove a lot of people out of the industry because restaurants were closed for a long time. And I don't know if, you know, they've not been able to recover from the talent drain that they experienced or whatever, but you guys provide some fractional services to like franchisees and other things. And I was kind of curious if you could give us maybe an overview about the challenges and the kind of things that you deal with in that industry. It's one that is a huge employer in the US, and you know, how that I just like to learn more about it.
Yeah. Well, absolutely. I just out of curiosity, have either one of you served at a restaurant before growing up or in your career?
Yes. I was a short order cook, my hand not here, a server, but I was the back of the house. I dishwasher, yeah. Busboy, and then cook for a long time through high school and college. So I was where
only,
I learned a lot.
Only of job cooking. I've ever been fired from.
Well, you know, I just asked because, you know, there's a large percentage of people in the U.S. and probably other countries as well that have started a career or been in the restaurant industry. And you're right, Michael, it's pretty volatile right now. It's been challenging. I think, you know, one of the headwinds that has been just hitting them hard for the last couple of years, obviously COVID was, you know, tragic, and those that made it through that probably were stronger after that, you know, than going, if you made it through it. But, you know, inflation has just been, it's been a really tough thing. And restaurants usually look at, they call it prime cost. And so it's labor and food cost or supply cost. And boy, that's just gone up, you know, substantially. I mean, you've seen it on billboards, right? You're going down the road and you look up and McDonald's is hiring a cook for a number that's, you know, 30%, 40% higher than a couple of years ago, and you're thinking, man, that's amazing. And and then the food cost has gone crazy, and prime cost generally is probably, you know, 60 to 70% of your sales. And I don't have the exact numbers, but I think that, you know, that number has had to drift up unless people have adjusted price. And I think that's, you know, part of the answer is you can, in the restaurant industry, you can make portions smaller. You can lower the quality of your cost. You can raise your price to try to adjust for this inflation thing going on. But the what's happening is 60%, you know, a recent survey just said about 60% of people are either spending less when they go out or trading down, mm-hmm. going to a different cost more or cost less. So that's been tough. And if organizations can't figure out how to control that, you can't lose money forever, right? How long do you lose money on a week to week, month to month basis before you got to say, hey, I'm out. I think the other big thing is the workforce. You know, it's been a challenge there. I would say though, it's better during the pandemic. We looked around and said, where'd everybody go? You know, where's all the workers? We couldn't get enough. And we had all these jobs we're trying to fill. I think that's gotten substantially better, but I do think that, you know, do we have the right people in the right seats? And you know, do we have the same level of engagement that we had, you know, back when? And I think then the other thing is, you know, how is the workforce responding to these things? So companies try to save money. Maybe they don't have as many employees on staff, or they're raising prices. And the workforce, I think, is you know, oftentimes not happy with how companies are handling those situations. Mm-hmm. So it may mean check out and stay. They may leave and go somewhere else, or they might, you guys here, right? They try to form a union. They do different things because they don't feel heard. They don't feel, you know, important. And what we try to really, you know, coach, you know, people we work with is you got to pay attention to your financials and your P&L, and you got to make sure that you got some money on the bottom line. So, you know, but at the same way, you got to make sure that you're doing so in a way that continues to engage and communicate well with your people, and make sure they understand as much as possible why, and have a plan to approach that, because you know, you won't exist tomorrow by performing like yesterday, right? Yeah. You just can't. And if you think you're just going to do it like you did pre-COVID or even a year or two ago and make it, I don't think you're going to make it. I think it's going to be, so you got to perform differently today, so you'll be here tomorrow. And I think that's what we're trying to say. And there's no cookie cutter approach to that either. I think that, you know, what is good for one organization might be totally different than another. So you got to kind of assess and look at that. But
Dana, but I think I'm sorry. I was just going to say, Dana, I'm curious about your, what are like a couple of, you know, you go into a restaurant or, you know, food business that's, you know, got some employee relations issues. What are some of your kind of like go-to tips to do what Tim says, which is to, like, you can't just focus on the bottom line, but what do you do to really engage? What are really challenging jobs? Very, very difficult jobs.
Right. Yep. I think a couple of things. So first of all is, you know, listening to the employees. Sometimes we go in and sometimes we'll just walk around and talk, right? Mm-hmm. What's going on? What do you like here? What's not going well? And then really focus with leadership and try to figure out their concerns. What are they facing, and how can we help them become the better leader to meet their employee needs? Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. kind of going back to your book too, Phil, approachability. You know, how mm-hmm. can we help them be more approachable? And because that's what our workers want today, right? Our new workforce of today. Does that leader care about me? Is that mm-hmm. meeting my needs? The other thing big, I think, Tim, you mentioned the workforce, and yeah, it tends to be a transient type workforce. I mean, there's not the commitment. I can work here until, oh, they're going to offer me 50 cents more. I'm going to leave tomorrow and probably just ghost their employer and never come back. And I think one thing about that is to help them with the schedule. Scheduling is a big thing in the restaurant industry. I you know, it's a weekend, late night job, and I think the key thing too is to look at that, is that employer being flexible with that? And there's a new tool. In fact, I just saw something come across my computer this morning about a tool that'll help employers do that and give the employee the ability to change schedules. Oh, I can't work Sunday. I got Johnny's birthday party. Oh, you know, Teresa, can you trade with me? And so I think that's a big thing too, is helping restaurants, you know, meet kind of that flexibility portion that their workforce wants today.
Mm-hmm. One thing I would just add to that too, Dana, I agree, does the employer understand what their people are thinking and understand the risk of what's going on? I think sometimes they're trying to address these issues that are real issues, but they don't know that there's a union risk looming, or they don't know what the real issues are, and they aren't asking the questions. And one of the tools and things that we do is we conduct roundtable discussions where we sit with employee groups and you know, face to face, not electronic, filling out the 67 page survey online to who knows where it goes, right? And we ask the question, how are things going? And how are they doing? And that face to face interaction. One of the times we did it, and one of the managers sat in the back, and he was just shocked at you know, all the information that they heard. Or we heard, just by asking that question and taking the time to do that. And but then it's also taking that information and trying to, how do you take that and quantify it and make it actionable so that you can actually do something with it?
There's with all of this kind of, you know, AI and all the analytics and all the stuff that you can do, it really boils down to a face-to-face conversation. And being able to get across the fact that, like, I care about you. I want you to have a great day at work. If you're struggling with something, let me see what I can do to try to help overcome that. These are very, very basic, simple. They're simple to do. That it's not easy during the rough and tumble day of at a restaurant or retail. I mean, pretty much any business to actually take that time. Yeah, that's why, you know, like, anybody can do a roundtable, right? That's not some like magic thing, but it's just taking the time to actually do it and have that conversation. It's a lot of times it's difficult to kind of get there.
Mm-hmm. Agrees.
So I'm curious about the working. So like, if you work with a franchisee, it's presumably an owner. I mean, it could be corporate, but presumably there's like a person, you know, a guy or whatever. And you guys are a vendor to that person. And then you also have to kind of act in the traditional HR role, which is a kind of a quasi advocate, quasi, you know, policy cop kind of thing. How does that work in a fractional role? And how are you effective in doing that? Because that has to be challenging.
Yeah, you know, I think that the reason we feel it's an effective way to approach HR is that regardless of what size you are, if you got more than one employee, you probably got some HR people things that you got to pay attention to. In fact, I always joke, you know, you go to a typical meeting of a department or a team, and I think they spend 60 or 70% of their time talking about people things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It just is, right? And so, but the fact is, a lot of organizations can't afford an HR director or a manager even. They need help, but they got to deal with those issues. And so, you know, a fractional HR support role is there, where somebody can call Dana and say, "Hey, I'm dealing with an issue," or maybe it's a regularly scheduled weekly meeting, and it's a resource for that organization to call and to talk through some of these very gray issues that can occur in a business. They can either, you know, if they don't do this, they could call legal, which, you know, one of our clients is saying, "Boy, that works, but expensive. You know, I don't know, $400 or $500 an hour, maybe." or you maybe make the decision without the guidance, and then later on you're dealing with some consequences.
Also, it'd be expensive.
More expensive than the attorney, yeah.
Yeah.
And so anyway, I think that, you know, we set up an intake with the client, get to know them. I think it's really important to understand as much about the business as possible, because in the end, we got to help that business be successful. If that business doesn't succeed, then nobody's got jobs, and we don't have a client. And so we got to make sure that we understand their business as best we can, And we kind of set up the cadence, you know, but I, you know, a lot of these things, like if it's employee relations, I think that sometimes we, well, most of the time you can't predict those things, right? They pop up and there's an issue and you got to deal with that is you know, quickly as you can.
Okay.
So Tim, in the, you know, kind of in assuming the role as a fractional HR person inside it, like, how do you address that with the like in these meetings you talked about doing focus groups or listening sessions, how do you address that with the employees and how do they receive it? And then also how do you like deal with an on-site manager, you know, because it there's always like a, you sort of mentioned that you got a call from HR once and you're like, oh, I was in trouble. You have a double thing, you're HR but you're also to some extent technically an outsider. So I'm kind of curious how you guys bridge that gap if there is one, and maybe there isn't.
Well, you know, I think it sort of depends on the scenario, but the HR fractional oftentimes operates sort of behind the scenes. And so what we want to try to do is enable the current leadership team who should be leading the business, and they do. We want to come alongside them and say, okay, what's going on? What's the best way to approach this? There are times where we say we need to talk to legal, right? Because this could be pretty sticky situation. There are times where we just coach them on, you know, do we coach the employee? Do we warn them and maybe guide them through the process and they do it. So they don't necessarily see Dana or I in a scenario like that. If we're conducting a roundtable discussion, then we set that up and we come in and we're presented as a independent third party coming to help learn more about the business, and the company wants to learn more and hear from you. And so they've hired Envision to come in and you know, ask you how things are going, and then we work through that process of, you know, asking questions and gathering the information, and we don't record names, in fact, you know, we wouldn't probably in most cases know the names anyway. Yeah. So it's anonymous, and then we provide that back to the owners or the leaders. The one benefit as the consultant is that sometimes the news, you got some really good things to share, and sometimes they're not so good, but we're not so worried about losing our job because we're going to tell them something that isn't, you know, good. We're just trying to make sure that they understand what the perception is from their team, from their employees, so they can address those. And then we also provide recommendations on a way to move forward with those things. So
I want to hear about Dana's book.
Yeah, that's awesome. I was going to say, we're going to switch to a couple different areas, but that's a great jump. So the title of the book is From the Mailroom to the Boardroom. And I don't think it's your first book either, but it just was released in June, right? So tell us about it.
Yeah.
And your co-author who's not on the show.
Correct. Yeah. So yeah. So it's From the Mailroom to the Boardroom, and it's kind of my co-author, Kirk Zell. He was also one of my bosses. He started out in sales similar to Tim, and as I mentioned, I started in the mailroom, and then he made it all the way up to the general manager of a, you know, multi-billion-dollar division or organization within Gordon Food Service. And so what we did is we collaborated on our stories of leading and people. And how I think we start out the book by saying, as I mentioned at the beginning of our conversation this morning, it's not about the finances and all that, even though we stress that's important, because if you're not making money and you're not paying attention to that, nobody's going to have a job, right? So, but it's about the thing that we're passionate about, as we've talked about, people, and how leaders need to understand and truly in the agape form love their people and focus on understanding. One thing that was always amazing to me is how I led during that day and how I treated people. That just didn't stay at the workplace. That resonated into the dinner table at night, right? Of the staff that I was entrusted to lead. And so I tell it kind of from the frontline perspective, and then working my way into HR. And then Kirk tells his way of working, you know, starting out as a sales, actually started out as in the back of the house in a restaurant, only went into work for a food service company because his restaurant went out of business. that he was working at. And his salesperson at the time says, hey, why don't you try sales? And his initial thought was, well, okay, I'll do that just to learn more about the food service and I'll go open my own restaurant. And he had, you know, ended up staying as I did, you know, 30 plus years. And so he worked his way up. I worked my way up from the board or from the mailroom into human resources executive. And he worked, like I mentioned, up until he'd be a GM. And it's all those steps in between and how we led.
Cool. Well, a lot of the best leaders are the leaders that sort of, you know, started at the bottom and kind of worked their way through and can still, you know, you made the point, but like can relate back to, I used to have this job. I used to work in the back of a restaurant. I used to work in a mailroom. I know what that day is like. And then to your point, that relationship with the leader, it's not like, okay, it's 5 o'clock and everyone goes home and you just like erase what just happened. You know, what just happened is what you're going to be talking about the rest of the day. And if that, even if it's a tough day, even if it's, you know, not everything went right, which is most days, you know, the feeling that you have about that leader and sort of, you know, you can either be kind of like coming through that and feeling horrible, or you can come through that and be like, wow, that was a tough day, but we like overcame a big challenge. And that really is just in the hands of your leader.
Right. Yeah. And I think that the big thing is that we learned, right? Kirk and I are telling our stories of our bumps and bruises along the way. You know, I think I tell a story in there about pride and ego, which we both, Kirk and I, and it felt that's kind of the downfall of many leaders. And I had one where I thought, boy, you know, we won Department of the Year, in a mail room, and boy, I had arrived. Mm-hmm. And then I had to do the company did their first 360 feedback session, and I got those results. I'm going, oh no. Then it was like, I'm in denial. They just didn't understand my job. So I'm going to tell them, you know, and then I get to read the comments, and it's like, oh no. And yeah, so my pride and ego was getting, it changed the way I was leading. And so, I mean, so there's stories like that about how, you know, the bumps and bruises and how we learned along the way about all these pitfalls that, you know, that we did in leadership and how we learned from them. So,
yeah,
I read the sample intro on your Amazon page, and in whatever portion of the book that came out of I believe it was in your portion, you said you realized as a leader early on, and the words sound really dramatic, but that you held the lives of people in your hands, and it's not like you're like, ha, I can crush them like some evil supervillain, but more so what you said a minute ago about how what you did and how you led them and how the experience that they had at work kind of carried forward throughout their day, right? And that really is kind of an awesome. That really is kind of an awesome responsibility. And it goes back to what you teach in approachability about like how it can improve not just your leadership life at work, but make your life at home better. And so this is something that I feel like many leaders don't understand and maybe take for granted. They don't know how much what they say or do impact someone.
The job of a leader is so hard. And like, we didn't really circle back to this, but the whole, you know, it's not just the economy and the labor market has like been hammering first line employees, but like that first line supervisor is stuck between, you know, the folks that are getting the work done day to day and then upper management that's like, we got to make the numbers, got to make the numbers. That job is so hard. And they're like some of the least engaged folks in America just because it is such a challenging job. And it's very easy to talk yourself into, you know, I'm stuck here. What I do doesn't really matter. I don't really have that big of an impact. Like it is so easy to talk yourself into that. And then Michael, to your point, you know, and then Dana and Tim, you know this too. You're powerful beyond your imagination, actually. Like you have massive impact, and the ripples of what you do during the day impacts not just that employee, not just that employee's family, their friends, you know, wherever else they pour themselves into, their community, their church, like their hobbies, like all of those relationships are really heavily impacted by that one extremely important relationship, which is your job, right? That's what pays for everything. And that's, you know, you get a lot of your personal value out of it. And if that day to day, you know, is garbage, like kind of the rest of your life is. And
right.
And leaders don't really think about it that way very often.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think, Phil, to your point, leadership, especially that as you mentioned, that frontline leadership. I mean, there's emails, right? Hundreds of emails today. Mm-hmm. Your boss is on you, like you said, the bottom line. Oh, your numbers, your production numbers, or whatever isn't where it needs to be. You have people. Your office is a revolving door.
Mm-hmm.
Constantly. And, you know, I can relate. At the end of the day, the last thing I really wanted to do after going, you know, 10, 11 hours at it, and then, you know, I got a line outside my door. But hey, mm-hmm. that's what that we signed up as a leader. You know, mm-hmm. we need to make sure that we address that line outside the door and don't put that other stuff as the major importance. Because it can be very easy to sit in front of this computer all day, right? And answer your emails, do all your reporting. You know, do all your meetings, that type of thing, and forget about, hey, those people, you're entrusted, you know, they're entrusted to you. Take care of them.
Yeah.
I think part of the the fabric of an organization, if they have open door policy where I'm willing to talk to you anytime you have a need, servant leadership, you know, that you're leading with a servant's heart and attitude, and your ego is checked at the door. And the organizations that can, you know, make that part of their culture and values, I think, tend to do better in that area. And that's kind of the world we grew up in. And really, you know, man, if I'm sitting in my office working, my door is not closed. It just isn't. You know, it's kind of figurative, but you know, it says, you got an issue, got a minute? Of course I do. Come on in. Let's talk. Mm-hmm. And trying to do that, just that simple door closed. And I get it. Sometimes if you're on a call like this, you got to have a door closed. But you know, I think there's subtle little things every day. And you're right, Phil. I think that we're entrusted to the care of these people that work for us, and we're impacting their lives. Is it for the positive, or are they at home talking about us at night, saying, "Man, I can't believe what happened today"?
Right. You're having an impact. Is what, you know, which kind is it?
Yeah. Exactly.
It took me about a third of my career to learn that chasing money, like I'd chase a salary, you know, I get a raise. Oh yeah, a new job, sure. But they weren't always necessarily the best circumstances, right? It was, you know, bad cultures or whatever. And I eventually realized that who you work with and who you work for make a whole hell of a lot of difference, more better long-term and in the culture of the organization. Mm-hmm. And we have a question we like to ask on the podcast, which I'm going to ask both of you here. And I'm going to jump to Dana first, just because apparently she's worked for everybody that ever was her manager. So that's so I'm not sure how you're going to single out.
She's obviously the one who gets stuff done. Yeah, like all of her bosses are like, well, you got to have Dana.
Right. Yeah, she's the GSD person, just like our FFP, right? Anyway, so the question is, and Dana, this might be challenging for you, and you may have to say everybody, but the question is, who's a leader that believed in you and helped you grow more than you thought you could?
Okay, I have to say Tim and the gentleman that I co-authored the book with, Kirk Zell, and I'll tell you why. Again, being in the mailroom, and I didn't have my college degree yet, okay, and yet Tim and Kirk saw something in me, tapped me on the shoulder and said, "Hey, do you want this director job at one of our, you know, a billion-dollar division in the company, one of them in the most profitable division?" It was this division that I was part of that was the profit center and helped, you know, build the other divisions. And again, frontline supervisor, no college degree yet, and they saw something in me and believed in me. And I went from a frontline to a director. That was a big jump. But with Tim and Kirk's support, I was able to do that. And again, the support they gave me to keep going and keep learning, which I think is key to any leader. Leaders never arrive, right? We've always got to keep learning, because what we do as leaders today probably won't work a month from now or a year from now. But and between the encouragement of those two, I was able to learn, grow, finish my college degree, and then move up even from a divisional director to a regional director because of Tim and Kirk's faith. And I want to tell this story that this is again about leadership. So I had been in my divisional role for a while, and I finally got my degree, and we were in an HR director's meeting that Tim was leading. And they gave me a plaque for my diploma, for my degree. And I still, that was back in 2009. And it, stuff like that still, I mean, I remember that day of Tim and his assistant at that time, Donna, you know, coming to me. I didn't even know they really realized I graduated, you know, and recognizing me in front of my peers. So little things like that. That leaders do stick again since 2009, how many years later, 13 years later, 13, 14 cool. years later, still remember that. So it's those little things that leaders do that will stay with people forever.
Yeah, for sure. How about you, Tim? Same question. Who believed in you?
Yeah, I think, that, you know, one reason maybe I, you know, looked at Dana and saw potential is because somebody did that for me. When I was in that sales role and I got that call to come to HR, I was still young. I had never managed before, didn't have an HR degree. You know, there was just a lot I didn't know. But the leader of HR at that time had worked with me. He knew that I had good relationships with my peers and with my boss. And with customers, and we saw that. And I think the other thing is he knew that I understood the business and kind of how it worked. And I remember him saying, I can teach you the HR stuff. We can get you up to speed on that. That's just knowledge. But he wanted the other stuff. And so I remember he'd sit, you know, he'd come in and then he let me, you know, present something, you know, a new project or a kickoff, a new initiative or something. And I'm presenting and I, frankly, probably had no business doing that, right? And so, but he let me go. But he was there as a safety net for me. It reminds me. Do you ever hear that story about the professor he's given a speech to college students all over the country, and he's given one speech after another, and finally he's just dead tired, and he says to his assistant, he goes, "I can't do it tonight. I'm just too tired." He goes, and the assistant says, "Well, you know, I've watched you do this for, you know, hundreds of times now." He goes, "I can do it. Let me do it." So he let him do it. So he presents to the next group, and it was flawless. He went through the presentation and the points and everything, and asked questions, and he answered every question to a T. And once the small guy in the back raises his hand and says, asks him a question he had never heard of before, and he didn't know what to do. He kind of panicked, and he says, "You know, that is the dumbest question I've ever heard. I can't believe you're asking me that question. That in fact, that's so dumb, I'm going to have my assistant answer it for you." Professor, right? And so, but Dave was, you know, he was the guy that knew, right? And I'm up there presenting and saying things. But man, I that was development, and that was investing time. And he knew that I could do it. Just, you know, I had to do it, you know. And So I've always, in fact, Dave's one of the guys you see in our team here. So, but he's been just a great mentor and had a lot of faith in me, even when I didn't. And, you know, I think that if we can, you know, and then, you know, Dana comes along and I think, man, you're right. She's a worker. She gets it done. And so a lot of potential there. And so, you know, so begins another journey there, which I think was wonderful and created another, you know, good opportunity for her.
Awesome. Well, I'm going to ask you a closing question, and it's two parts. But first of all, thanks for being our guest today. Really appreciate the discussion, the chance to sit down with you guys. And I'm gonna lead with Phil, because we do we always try to do a sort of fun wrap up, not really pertinent to leadership or any of the more tough topics. So when your turns come, though, you'll get a chance to add any final thoughts and then share your perfect concert. So Phil, if you could pick two artists that you would pair together, and it can be in a performing in concert or on one song, who would you like to see as your like dream combo for a musical performance?
This is a tough one. Well, one of them they already did it, which is the Rockin' Tours, which is you know, Jack White and Brendan Benson, which is like an amazing band. I like both those guys. I would probably do Neil Young and Matthew Sweet. Matthew Sweet is like my desert island. He's a little off the beaten path, but like if I can only bring one artist, but it's because he plays a lot of Neil Young songs, and so he plays a bunch of other stuff that I really like. But anyway, those two would be really cool to see together. Awesome. And yeah, Dana and Tim, thanks so much for joining us. I'm anxious to hear your dream concert.
Go ahead, Dana.
Okay, so being from Michigan, I had to think about this because I was more probably rock back in my younger days, and then last 20 years probably been more country. So I had to chose kind of a combination of both, which today they would both be considered country, and one is, and that is Kid Rock and Bob Seger.
Ooh. I like it.
Yeah. Remember the live album? Boy, when I was growing up, that live, Live Bullet, it was called, you know, and then Turn the Page.
Yep. Get out of Denver.
Little Too Tall. I was at two of those shows.
I recorded like five nights. I was at two of those shows back in the day. So how about you, Tim?
Yeah, it's a tough one because I got such an eclectic music taste. I like, you know, almost every type of genre, but kind of going back, and this probably isn't possible, but because one of them's dead, but Nat King Cole, who I remember my mom and dad, just that smooth voice and, you know, easygoing style, and Ed Sheeran, the singer-songwriter.
That's very eclectic.
Yeah, it would be. Cool. I wonder what they would do. Like, you know, just, you know, what would come out of that. So, anyway.
Yeah.
What about you, Michael?
It's funny. I saw a TikTok video about the David Bowie Queen song "Under Pressure," where they were saying like Bowie sang all the lyrics, and all Freddie ever did was go like bee 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 bop. But I loved that song, and I would love to have seen them do an album. So that would have been, or a concert, that would have been cool. I've always been a huge Bowie fan, and Freddie Mercury, of course, got lost way too early. So that was that. And I've seen two shows, Billy Joel and Elton John, which is kind of the classic example that helped me think up this idea. And I also saw Sting and Peter Gabriel, which was maybe the best concert I've ever seen. And one of the most humorous, in that you had to see Peter Gabriel, who at this stage of his life looks like an old English plumber, dancing and performing an English, the Sting song, the English Gentleman, whatever that is called.
Yeah, right.
So Peter was dancing, if you can call it that. It was hysterical. So anyway, thanks a lot. We're going to go ahead and end the show, and we'll chat with you again down the road. Thanks for being our guest.
Thanks, Dana. Thanks, Tim.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, we appreciate it. Take care.
Thanks. Bye-bye.